So the answer is, should I call the FBI?
I think it would be wise to let the FBI
know. You're going to be the director of the FBI, pal. So here's what I want you to tell every politician. If you get a call from somebody suggesting that a foreign government wants to help you by disparaging your opponent, tell us all to call the FBI.
To the members of this committee, any threat or effort to interfere with our elections from any nation state or any non-state actor is the kind of thing the FBI would want to know.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham grilling Christopher Wray during his confirmation hearing today. President Donald Trump picked Wray to head the FBI after he fired James Comey. Wray seems to be on the path to easy confirmation. He impressed senators from both parties with his pledge to remain independent. But the hearing comes just a day after Trump's son, Don Jr., tweeted out an email exchange in which he was promised some incriminating information on Hillary Clinton via the Russian government. Those emails lay out plans for a meeting between Donald Jr. and a Russian lawyer named Natalia Veselnitskaya. She's been described as both a Kremlin insider and also a low-level, one-issue activist. Well, here to tell us more about her and her ties to the Russian government is Andrew Kramer, Moscow correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you. So which is she? Is she a Kremlin insider or just a low-level attorney who caught a lucky break?
Well, we still don't know what's been discussed at this meeting last spring, so when that comes out in more detail, her exact role might be more clear. In the emails that were revealed that were apparently used to set up this meeting, Donald Trump Jr. was told that she was a Russian government lawyer. From all indications in Russia, that's not necessarily true. She was in private practice. She is a divorced a real estate lawyer, 42 years old, who was active in very fiercely fought legal cases on the outskirts of Moscow for land plots that were valuable for developing malls and freeways and other infrastructure as the city grew. Mm-hmm. This was her primary activity for the past at least 10 years or so before she got caught up in this scandal.
So kind of like a land use attorney in a way. But does she have any ties to Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin?
None that are publicly known. Her primary client was a regional official in the Moscow Oblast. This is the region around Moscow that doesn't include the city, the outskirts of Moscow. And he was a prominent official. He's been compared to somebody maybe along the lines of Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, somebody with connections to power but not really powerful in the federal government.
Okay, but it has been reported that she was interested in this Magnitsky Act, and that's the U.S. law that labels Russians 18 or so as human rights abusers and sanctions them. And it was named after this guy, Sergei Magnitsky, who was found dead under suspicious circumstances in a Moscow prison. First of all, tell us a little more about Sergei Magnitsky and the Magnitsky Act, and then why Veselnitskaya would be interested in getting that overturned.
The Magnitsky Act was the first sanction law targeting insiders in Russia, and it was passed in 2012 and named after an accountant who died in Russian prison, as you mentioned. It targets Russian officials who are accused of human rights abuse but haven't been punished at home under Russian law. And it was something the Russian government was vehemently opposed to. The reason why Veselnitskaya got involved in lobbying against it is because the son of her primary client, Denis Katsev, had invested in Manhattan real estate, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, with some of the proceeds from the Magnitsky fraud. Her client had about $20 million in New York real estate, and she was fighting the seizure of those assets in a money laundering, a civil money laundering case related to the Magnitsky law. Because of this, she started to advocate against the Magnitsky law, lobbying in Congress, promoting a movie that opposed the law, and other activities. So she was the face of this Russian effort to repeal the Magnitsky law, which certainly dovetailed with the Russian government's position, but she was not formally, at least, employed by the Russian government.
Right. Okay. So, but why is this of interest to the Russian government?
Well, this would be of interest because the Russian government opposes that law that sanctions high-level officials. And in Russia, that's seen as a precursor to other sanctions which came after the invasion intervention in Ukraine and meddling in the 2016 election. The Russian government is a foreign policy goal of Russia is to have these sanctions repealed. Now, when she met with Donald Trump Jr., she apparently discussed the Magnitsky sanctions. All sides agree on that. And the question really is whether she used the Magnitsky issue as a pretext to meet with Donald Trump to convey as yet unknown compromising information about the Hillary Clinton campaign from the Russian government to assist in the election of Donald Trump, or whether it was the other way around. She was teasing the campaign about information she might have from the Russian government that would be helpful to the campaign, and in which Donald Trump Jr. agreed to meet with her and receive this information, when in fact she really wanted to discuss her pet issue, as it were, the Magnitsky Law.
Well, let's listen to her explanation. Here she is on NBC.
They had the impression, it appears, that they were going to be told some information that you had about the DNC. How did they get that impression?
It's quite possible that maybe they were looking for such information. They wanted it so badly.
Okay, so she's basically denying she had any damaging information on Hillary Clinton given to her by anyone in the Russian government. So I guess that's still the big question, whether or not she had that information and whether or not anyone gave it to her if she indeed had it.
Well, that is a question. Even if the information was perhaps not so dramatic or would not have influenced the election, what's interesting here is the willingness of the Trump campaign to accept that information and as far as the emails indicate, knowing that it came directly from the Russian government, and once again citing these emails as part of an ongoing effort by the Russian government to assist Donald Trump in his campaign to be elected president. One hint in the NBC interview, Veselnitskaya said that she discussed tax evasion by an American investor. We don't know if that was part of the compromising information she wanted to convey, but it may have involved some issues related to the Magnitsky Law that possibly could have been used in the campaign. This is speculation. For now, it's not clear what the Trump campaign got out of this.
Right. So still a lot of unanswered questions. And just very quickly, one other unanswered question is the role of Agalarov, this billionaire real estate investor who's been called the Donald Trump of Russia. And he has close ties to Vladimir Putin?
Well, all of the oligarchs in Russia are in the orbit of the Kremlin in order to stay in business. Agalarov is the 61st most wealthy man in Russia, or person in Russia, rather, according to Forbes. So he's not in the top tier of Russian oligarchs, but he's high enough up that that there would likely be some connections to the government. His company's won government contracts. He's primarily involved in mall and shopping center development in Moscow. And his son is a pop star who has appeared often on television in Russia. And there's some debate as to whether he bought his way into the business or he is actually popular.
Okay. Andrew Kramer, Moscow correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, what it means to be homeless in Los Angeles. We're going to meet a woman who lives with her son in a motel room. If she can make enough money each day to afford the room, that story is next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. All week long, KCRW is looking at the issue of homelessness here in Los Angeles. The latest numbers show homelessness is up more than 20%. 58,000 people in L.A. County are homeless. KCRW's Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez are reporting on L.A. housing issues for an upcoming podcast series. It's called There Goes the Neighborhood. And they join me now to update us on some of the findings when it comes to homelessness. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, so let's begin with you. One of the people you have spent time with is a woman named Sandra, a single mom. Her son is 11 years old. And tell us about her situation.
Sandra lives in a motel just in South L.A. County. And she's an example. You know, so many people Anna and I have met represent, they have one foot in the house world and one foot in the homeless world. And this is Sandra's situation.
I work about like maybe 60 to 70 hours a week.
Here at the motel?
Here at the motel. And that money goes to him, to the manager of the motel. And
what do you mean it goes to him?
Yeah, I make the money, I cash it, and the cash goes to him, basically.
So basically you're working for your room.
Yes.
And is it most of your paycheck or all of your paycheck?
All of my paycheck.
And if she doesn't earn enough money that day, Madeline, the owner says, bye-bye, see you tomorrow, come back.
Was she paid per room that she cleans?
Per room that she cleans. But if she doesn't make enough, because you know she has other expenses, food and medical care. Her son needs medical care. And if she does not make enough, she has to go out on the streets.
And how much is her hotel room?
$65 during the weekdays, $75 during the weekends.
Hmm. Wow. So, and obviously it must be more difficult that she's with her son.
Oh, absolutely. You know, she, like any good mother, good parent, she wants the very best for her son. And she knows where he's at an age now where this is no longer a great adventure, right, that they're on together. Now he feels fear. Where are we going to go tonight, Mom? We're going to be tomorrow night if you can't afford to pay for this motel room. And this is what she told me about how she's reacting to her son's fear.
I tell him I'm working on it. Just be patient. You know, that's all I can tell him. And I know this affects him because we fight all the time for like the smallest things, you know. But he's not little anymore. He understands what's going on. And I just don't want him to be scarred from all this. You know, I don't want him to be, upset with me or anything.
Oh, that is so sad to hear her. And I'm wondering, so when she doesn't make enough money to afford the motel room for that night, where does she go?
The street. And
literally?
I mean literally the street.
With her son.
With her son on the sidewalk, safe, you know, sort of safe corners or safe alleys in the immediate neighborhood around the motel. Or sometimes she can get into like a local church shelter. But those are her options. Mm-hmm. And sometimes her son can be sent away to his father on particular nights, and she tries to do that whenever possible. But for Sandra, it's always, if it's not a shelter, it's on the street. And to make extra money, Madeline, you know, along with her motel house cleaning job, she also cleans homes here in West LA on the West Side. And she's quite honest about this. She begs. And why doesn't she have enough housing? Because she says it is so darn tough to earn enough money to make that first and last month's rent and, you know, possible security check as well.
Wow. Anna, let's bring you into this conversation as we heard this very moving story about this woman begging literally on the streets so she can afford a place to live. Why is it so difficult to build affordable housing here in Los Angeles?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. The main thing is when it comes to affordable housing, we just don't have a steady stream of funding in the city of Los Angeles for affordable housing. We used to have community redevelopment agencies that funded a lot of affordable housing, but we don't have those anymore. Voters did pass Measure HHH in November, which is going to fund 10,000 units of permanent supportive housing for the formerly homeless. But that's over a period of years. And not to be a negative Nancy, it's very much needed, but 10,000 units when we have more than 30,000 people just in the city is only a sliver of what we need. Mm. And in the meantime, we've also seen more than 20,000 rent-controlled units go up to market rate with evictions since 2001. That's a lot.
Right, and puts pressure on people further down as well.
Yeah.
So there are fewer available apartments that are affordable, and so some people lose out entirely.
Exactly. Rent-controlled apartments, you can only raise the rents very small amounts as long as there's a tenant in there, but as soon as they're empty, they can go up to whatever market rate is. So we've seen thousands of apartments go up to market rate and get locked into these new expensive rates. So
So it seems like a cruel version of musical chairs. What about forcing developers to build affordable housing? Is that being considered?
Well, it's actually illegal to make a blanket law that all private developments have to have some affordable component for very complicated reasons that I won't go into, but that's out of the toolbox. So a lot of the time what it comes down to is individual city council members negotiating to have some small amount of affordable housing in a project in exchange for more height, more density, some kind of special exception on a development project. Just this week, I talked to Mitch O'Farrell, the city councilman for District 13, which includes Hollywood and Echo Park, and he said he's doing this in his district.
We are building affordable housing with almost every single project that has market rate in it. I would argue very strongly that people who need affordable housing also deserve to have nice, comfortable, adequate housing, and that's what we're building. In almost all of the projects in Hollywood that I've negotiated that are market rate, they also have a component of affordable, 5%, 10%, and more percent.
I think it's important to also mention there are a number of measures in the pipeline at the city level, and it would take the whole segment to run through them all. But one of the ones that the mayor has talked about the most is this proposal to have what's called a linkage fee, which is kind of jargony, but basically it's a fee on new construction that would fund affordable housing. If it goes through, it's supposed to generate about $100 million a year for affordable housing, but the city council has not voted on that yet. It keeps being delayed, and so the latest is that it may be voted on later this month or sometime after that.
Saul, what about the federal piece of this with Section 8 housing? Those are vouchers to help people rent apartments on the open market.
Absolutely. You get a voucher, Section 8 voucher, and it's supposed to take care of most of your housing costs, and you just pay a fraction of the rent. But I'll tell you what, Madeline, I was at the Housing Authority of Los Angeles today, where there's a very long line every morning for people having Section 8 voucher problems. All of them have the vouchers, Madeline. Every single person I talked to had a voucher. None of them could find a place that would accept the voucher. Because in this market, as Anna was just saying, in this market where rents are right now, it's in the landlord's self-interest to charge more and go to the open market to the non-voucher holding public and get them as renters. So what did the Section 8 voucher people do? Well, they're homeless.
Yeah.
Even though they
have the
support.
Voucher is just not enough.
Exactly. The voucher is not enough, or they start looking other places. So they try to go up to Palmdale or Lancaster. Well, maybe I can find something affordable there. They'll go to Long Beach. They'll go to the Inland Empire. And just about every person I talked to is going from community to community, getting a voucher there and hoping that they'll find a place that they can take their voucher to and will actually accept them as a renter.
Okay. So meanwhile, getting back to people who are homeless, there's also this measure that voters passed, Measure H, which provides wraparound care, right? Drug addiction care, mental health care, help finding a job, that kind of thing. Is that going to go a long way to helping the homeless?
Hopefully. They just started collecting money from that, so time will tell. I think that that we have a drug epidemic in the country that's been well documented. And certainly it's not unreasonable to think that we're seeing some of that here in Los Angeles. And just anecdotally, when I go out and talk to people on the streets, I'm surprised by how many people are struggling with addiction. I think it's something that we don't talk about that much. And I think it's also something that people don't always reveal immediately. At least that's been my experience when you talk to them, because there is so much stigma around addiction. But I think it needs to be a really serious part of the conversation that we look at really closely here in LA to tackle this problem.
Do you think that officials are acknowledging that they are trying to tackle this?
Yeah, I do think that there is a serious effort to try to tackle it. Voters passed Measure H in March, which part of what that's going to do is provide addiction services to homeless people. But I don't think it gets talked about enough in our public conversations. I think a lot of the time when we talk about the homeless numbers, we talk exclusively about how it's related to the housing crisis. And certainly that's a big factor. The lack of affordable housing in Los Angeles is a real problem. But I think we need to take a serious look at the impact of addiction as well.
Well, thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KCRW reporters Anna Scott and Saul Gonzalez are working on a new podcast. It's called There Goes the Neighborhood, and you can find out all about it and share your LA housing story at kcrw.com/theregoestheneighborhood. Well, we just talked about the challenges of figuring out the homeless problem here in L.A. But homelessness and poverty are also problems outside the city, in the suburbs. The growth of poverty in American suburbs is one of the most important and overlooked demographic changes in the last few decades. And that's according to our next guest. Scott Allard studies poverty in cities across the United States, including here in Los Angeles. He's a professor at the University of Washington. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand that a trip to a food pantry outside Los Angeles really sparked your interest in suburban poverty. Tell us about that trip.
Yeah, about 10 years ago, this particular food pantry was in the Valley. And as I started to drive out, I noticed that, you know, I was getting farther from the city and further out in L.A. County, and started driving through neighborhoods that to me felt more like the Brady Bunch than a place where you'd expect to find poverty. And when I arrived, the executive director met me and walked me through the facility. And it was striking to hear stories of how their caseload had doubled in the last year. And when you walked around, the shelves, many were empty, not because people weren't donating, but because they couldn't keep enough food in stock. It went right out to the families in need in the community. And it challenged some of my assumptions about poverty in America. You know, as a scholar of poverty, I often, you know, thought about poverty as being kind of an urban or rural phenomenon. But this experience really, really challenged that notion. And so what I did the next couple of days was I started to visit a few other suburban service providers, including some that actually spent time providing homeless services in the suburban region. And I was really struck at how the problem of homelessness, which is also something we often think of as an urban phenomenon or reality, was really present in many suburban areas across the LA metro.
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to tease out what a suburb is in Los Angeles. As Dorothy Parker famously said, LA is 72 suburbs in search of a city. So how do you delineate between the city and the suburbs when it comes to Los Angeles and poverty?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think many of the suburban, if you will, communities in Los Angeles, you know, are negligibly different than many of the neighborhoods within the city itself. You know, Los Angeles itself has a residential feel that might seem suburban at some level. I spent a lot of time debating kind of how to count places like Anaheim or places like Burbank or however you think about it. The way we talk about poverty has a geographic label to it, which doesn't actually conform to maybe some of the other ways that we think about what is urban or suburban.
Well, so why do we think of it as an urban phenomenon? Is that because until, you know, I guess until fairly recently, a lot of the poor people were located in the cities and maybe in housing developments. You know, Lyndon Johnson had his famous War on Poverty, where he focused on the inner city. Is that why? Is it just rooted in decades of kind of misconception of who is poor?
I think you have it right when you trace our connections of what is urban to poverty back to the War on Poverty, to the Great Society. In the 1960s, when we were launching programs to fight poverty in America, they were framed often around poverty being in central cities or being in rural communities. And suburbs actually weren't even part of the conversation. You'd be hard-pressed to find reference to the suburbs in any of the legislative debates or policy debates at the time. And at that point, that actually reflected the demographic realities of the country. But that's changed over the last 50 years. And even though we might think of suburban poverty as being a relatively recent phenomenon, if you go back to 1990, you see that there were almost as many poor people in the suburbs of our largest metros as in the cities themselves. And so I think suburban poverty has really been a blind spot. We think of poverty as being urban. And it shapes not only how we understand problems, but it shapes how we think about solutions.
Mm. Well, we think of it as being urban because we can see it more, I guess. And you know, when you're driving through the suburbs, perhaps it's just not as visible.
Sure, yeah. I think in cities, poverty has a more visible element to it. You know, we see it in our cities, in our day-to-day lived experiences. In suburbs, poverty can be tucked away in cul-de-sacs or trailer parks or apartment complexes that might be, you know, off of interstate interchanges or, you know, major throughways. And in many ways can be quite hidden from view. And that's just the nature of suburban design in many ways.
So who are the suburban poor?
Well, the suburban poor are much like the urban or rural poor. They're our friends, our families, our neighbors, individuals, adults who are looking for work but can't find enough full-time work or can't find a job that pays enough. many poor families in cities and suburbs and rural communities all struggle with the realities of today's labor market, where there just aren't as many good-paying jobs that don't require advanced training or skill as there used to be. Poverty in suburbs reflects the racial and demographic characteristics of suburban communities, and so it's no different than in urban or rural areas in that way either.
I think a lot of us think, well, this really came into focus during the Great Recession, when the housing crisis forced a lot of people out of their homes and into poverty or into dire straits. Is that true, that the Great Recession accelerated this problem in the suburbs?
Definitely. The Great Recession hit suburban America more directly than any prior economic recession in the post-war era, at least. And it had a sustained impact on suburban workers and on suburban labor markets, as well as the housing market. And what you see when you look at the data is that the increases in poverty that had been building steadily over the last several decades in suburban America suddenly took a more dramatic uptick, and the rate of change picked up. And so many communities saw the number of people living below the poverty line, you know, double or triple in a relatively short period of time. But it's important to keep in mind those trends were building for several decades. It wasn't just a phenomenon of the mid-2000s. We would be talking about poverty problems today in suburbs, even if the Great Recession hadn't happened, because that's where the demographic trends were headed well before the recession. But in suburbs, there may be some unique aspects to the experience of poverty, which are helpful for us to keep in mind. One is the distances often are so great to travel, whether it's for work or school or to receive social services, that if you don't have a car, it can be really difficult to get around. Another reality that I think makes it different is oftentimes our suburban communities aren't well positioned to provide the supports that working poor families need to make ends meet, to grapple with a short-term loss of work earnings, or to grab the next rung on the ladder. Our safety net is highly predicated on poverty being concentrated in cities, and there's a real lag in the capacity of suburban safety nets to meet the need that's present.
And by that, you're talking about nonprofits?
Mostly nonprofits. The nonprofit human service sector is a really critical aspect of our safety net. We actually overlook it often, and we often have conversations about Medicaid or SNAP or the Earned Income Tax Credit. But nonprofit human services provide anywhere from $100 to $150 billion a year of assistance to low-income families. And these organizations are community-based. They're local. And they provide a lot of critical assistance, whether it's emergency food assistance, job training, housing assistance. But our nonprofit capacity is highly concentrated in cities. For every roughly $10 we spend on human services in cities, we spend $1 in suburbs, even though there are more poor people in suburbs numerically than in cities.
So what do we do about this? How do we help people in the suburbs?
We have to recognize that there's a shared fate in cities and suburbs to reducing poverty. For too long, cities and suburbs have had a competitive dance between each other. And we're not going to solve the poverty problems in our metro areas if suburbs and cities don't work together, if we don't recognize that there's a shared fate. And that's really easy to say. It's really difficult work to do. But we're not likely to solve poverty problems in our cities or suburbs if we don't find common ground and common ways to come together to support programs and policies that we know will work to help low-income households, no matter where they're located in our communities.
Scott Allard, he's the author of a new book called Places in Need, The Changing Geography of Poverty. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. A lot of people are struggling with the cost of living in and around Los Angeles. Are you among them? How are you making ends meet? And what's your perception of poverty in LA and in the suburbs? You can share your story with us on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the LAPD has relied on its K-9 unit to reduce the number of potentially fatal encounters between cops and suspects.
The problem with a copper with a gun chasing a suspect with a gun is when that cop finds the suspect, it's instant. There's probably only going to be one outcome, and it's very, very fast.
But when a dog confronts a suspect, the potential for fatal violence is a lot lower. That story is next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The LAPD has one of the worst records for officer-involved shootings in the nation. But the police have actually done a lot to avoid potentially deadly encounters between armed officers and suspects on the run. Their strategy? Release the dogs. Police departments all over the country admire the LAPD for its canine unit. In fact, other departments have come here to learn the best way to train police dogs. David Weinberg rode along with the LAPD to see how they work with their canine partners.
I met up with LAPD Sergeant Michael Gooseby in the parking lot of the Police Academy in Echo Park. Gooseby is the head trainer for the canine unit, and I climbed into his car for a trip into the mountains. As we headed out of the city, his dog Robbie whined incessantly from inside the metal cage in the back of the SUV. But Gooseby said it didn't bother him all that much. After a dozen years training dogs, he was used to it.
So whenever they get in the car, they get really anxious and everything because they're always anticipating that at some point that door's going to pop open and I'm going to go search for somebody or go get to do some bite work. So he's excited right now.
That constant state of excitement or agitation is precisely the quality you want in a police dog.
We choose dogs like this because they have the energy and the drives to go on and on and on, and we need this some nice during police work.
To the untrained eye, Robbie looks like a German Shepherd, but he's not. The LAPD uses Dutch Shepherds, which tend to be a little lighter than German Shepherds, and they have a slightly different slope to their back. The SUV climbs up an elevation to a remote shooting range on the edge of the San Gabriel Mountains. Once a month, the entire canine unit comes here for firearms training. On a bare patch of dirt that's been carved out of the mountain, the officers line up and take aim at paper targets strung across a metal beam. Behind them is a row of idling cars, and inside each car is a dog. This is also part of the dog's training. They have to learn to hear the explosive sound of gunfire and not freak out.
Shooter standby. Gun!
But they have to limit the dog's exposure. Unlike the officers, the dogs don't wear ear protection. Too much gunfire, and they could lose their hearing. Police dogs do lots of different kinds of work, like search for explosives, sniff out illegal drugs, or search through rubble for survivors. But these dogs, which are part of the Metropolitan Division, are trained to do one thing: find people who are on the run from the police.
When we get the call, we already know that this individual that we're looking for has done something, and in most cases will do something again.
Lieutenant Michael Carradine is the commanding officer of the Metropolitan Division Canine Unit, which serves all of Los Angeles, but they only go out on very specific calls.
And I'll give you a hypothetical. You may have a foot pursuit in Southeast Division of a man with a gun or a car theft suspect. Those are both felonies. Southeast Patrol will then go ahead and set up a containment or perimeter. Then they will call the desk here at Metropolitan Division.
Once the canine unit gets the call saying that the suspect's location has been surrounded by patrol officers, they determine how many dogs to send out in the search area.
And they have to have someone that can identify that individual. If it meets that criteria, then we will roll.
And once they arrive on the scene, the officers play an announcement on loudspeakers, in English and in Spanish. It's a warning to the suspect and to anyone in the area that dogs are about to be released into the neighborhood. One of the officers played the recording for me on his cell phone.
This is the Los Angeles Police Department. We are searching for a suspect and are preparing to use a police dog. For your safety, please go inside your home or business and stay inside until we have completed our search. To the person or persons who are hiding from the police, put down all weapons, come out with your hands raised, and follow directions. You have 1 minute to surrender.
I went on a ride-along with a canine unit on a Friday night. As calls came in steadily over the police radio, all the officers working the shift traveled to an abandoned building next to USC campus. There are a lot of spots like this one across the city that the police use for training. Tonight, one of the officers is putting on a heavily padded bite suit and ambling into the building where he will hide in a second floor room, sweating silently in the dark, while dogs take turns searching for him.
Here. But he got up on his hind legs. He's checking the scent.
The officer scans the room with a flashlight, illuminating bits of graffiti scrawled on the wall. Lots of Bible verses and the ramblings of what seems like a mentally unstable squatter. The dog races from room to room, sniffing around for the smell of a person in hiding.
The scent is coming off the person, and if you can imagine a plume of smoke coming off, and as the smoke moves, it goes out to edges, and then and it attaches to things, attaches to walls, and attaches to objects, and the dog will hit on those objects, and then he'll turn and kind of follow that scent back to its source.
The LAPD does things differently than most other canine units around the country. Basically, there are two ways to train dogs. One is called find and bite. The dog finds the suspect, grabs him or her with its teeth, and holds on until the officers arrive. In the 90s, the LAPD canine unit was saddled with so many bite-related lawsuits that the unit was almost shut down. Since then, they've changed the way they train their dogs to the other method, which is called find and bark. When the dog barks, it lets the officers know where the suspect is hiding, and then they move in.
And then if the suspect makes a move, or if directed by the handler can still give the direction, then the dog can bite.
The dogs don't know who they're looking for. So when a dog barks at a bystander who lives in the area, or who maybe ran in fear of the dog, the police have to step in and let the dog know it's not the suspect, and the search continues. So far this year, the canine unit has successfully found 155 suspects in hiding. Of those finds, the dogs bit 39 people, or 25%, which is just within the department's target bite ratio. One of the reasons the LAPD likes to use dogs in searches is because it cuts down on the number of confrontations between a suspect and an armed officer. Confrontations that have the potential to end badly. Here's Canine Sergeant Arno Clare.
The problem with a copper with a gun chasing a suspect with a gun is when that cop finds the suspect, it's instant. There's probably only going to be one outcome. And it's very, very fast. It's a lot to expect of both the suspect as well as the police officer to try to negotiate at that moment.
But when a dog confronts a suspect, it gives police time to slow the whole situation down.
And it's just a safer, maybe more humane way of going about looking for these guys that are often out of their minds, on drugs, emotionally imbalanced, and you know all the other factors you can throw into crime.
As valuable as it is to have dogs confront suspects, it doesn't happen all that often, given the very specific circumstances needed to deploy the canine unit. In fact, the night I spent with the unit, they didn't go out on a single call, despite the fact that there was constant action on the police radio. On any given day in Los Angeles, it's not unusual for 6,000 calls to come across the radio.
Think about that all day long, 6,000 incidents. And these are all really stressful, spontaneous, unpredictable situations that the officers either ran into, came across, or were directed to by way of a radio call. And within minutes, it's taken care of.
Over in Chavez Ravine, there's a plateau on a hill in between Dodger Stadium and the police academy. And there's a fenced-in patch of grass that Sergeant Gooseby and the other trainers take the dogs to. One evening a few weeks ago, Gooseby brought Robbie up there to play fetch.
I look at him right now, and I just see this big goofball.
Sometimes Gooseby would tell Robbie to wait before he went to fetch his toy.
Leave it.
And when Robbie didn't obey those commands, Gooseby pressed a button on a small remote that sent an electrical shock through Robbie's collar.
Los! Bleiben. Bleiben. Bleiben.
Like a lot of the dogs, Robbie was brought here from Holland, so he was trained in Dutch.
We get some dogs from Slovakia and Czech Republic, and they are Hungary and have different languages. We retrain them all in Dutch, generally.
Of the dogs that Gooseby trains, about half don't have what it takes to become police dogs. Luckily, they can return them if they don't pan out. Each of the dogs costs $11,000. And the ones that do make it tend to be what Gooseby calls GED dogs.
Is that dog that barely made it through high school and he spent every day in the principal's office. He just did just enough to get that C to get out of there.
The higher achieving dogs, the PhD dogs, as he calls them, tend to be too rigid. Their general dogness has been trained out of them.
It can't always be work for them, work, work, work. They need to have that dog side of them. If you lose that dog side of them, then you do lose the sociability of them. You know, they're not social as much anymore. Because I don't want him to look at me as a, I'm his pack leader and I'm in charge of the pack, but I'm not as disciplinarian. You know, I don't want him to look at me in that light. He needs to see me as, that's my buddy, that's my pal, but he's in charge. And, you know, so we just come out here sometimes and just do this. Robbie, leave it. See? He's getting closer to the gate. Oh, dude, you're not slick.
In the distance, the sound of gunshots from the police academy ricocheted off the walls of Chavez Ravine. The sun was setting, so Gooseby let Robbie have a few more minutes of fetching his toy before he had to jump back into the car and get back to work.
Boy!
I'm David Weinberg for KCRW.
Coming up on the program, there are just two porn theaters in Los Angeles. They are both on Santa Monica Boulevard. We're going to get a tour, sort of a virtual tour, really, next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR. La, la,
la, la, la, la. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Linda Lovelace is back.
No, she isn't really. You know, the star of the famous porn film Deep Throat. She's not back. All of Southern California porn movie theaters that played in that movie probably not coming back either. There are very few left. In fact, just two. Carolina Miranda has the story. She writes the culture high and low column for the LA Times. You've really gone low this time.
I have.
Okay. Why did you want to do a story about porn theaters?
It was interesting. It started off actually as a question from an editor. They were doing a package about movie theaters, the future of the movie theater at the LA Times. And they were like, you know, is there any sort of movie theater related idea that comes into your mind? And I don't usually cover film. Uh-huh. And I thought back to this New Year's dinner I had been at where it was a big party. And then somebody stopped the party and said, hey, how many people in this room have seen porn inside an actual porn theater? And only like two or three hands went up out of this room full of people,
including yours,
including mine. Yeah, that's another story. And I was just really intrigued by it. I was like, I almost couldn't believe it. Like, really, no one here has gone to a porn theater? And then I went, and then I was like, you know, now that I think about it, like growing up in LA, you used to see the marquees with the XXX everywhere. And I was realizing that I didn't really see them anywhere anymore. And so I started digging around and found that there were only two left.
And they both happen to be on Santa Monica Boulevard.
They do. They do. They frame, as I like to say, they frame an LA in a porno magnetic field.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, let's talk about one of them, Studs.
Yes, that is a media scholar at the University of Oregon describes Studs as a Smithsonian of porn.
Really?
Yes, it used to be in the 1970s and 80s one of the famous Pussycat Theaters, which was a chain of theaters primarily in Southern California and operated out of Southern California. And the Studs was kind of like the marquee theater. It was where the big Deep Throat opening happened. It was where a lot of famous 1970s porn films had their openings. And, you know, back in the day, those films had openings as big as any Hollywood opening. There would be a line around the block. There would be Klieg lights. There would be limousines. There would be red velvet rope. Oh, yeah. It was a scene.
It was the 70s.
It was the 70s. It was the golden age of porn, as they call it. And the Studs was where the Pussycat sort of most famous location was based, so much so that there is a little porn walk of fame located outside of it, where famous porn stars put their handprints and their footprints in the cement, a la Chinese theater, man's Chinese theater. And so John Holmes, Linda Lovelace, Harry Reams, all of these very famous names of 1970s porn have left little vestiges of themselves there.
Well, you went inside.
I sure did.
The theater. And what did you see?
Well, after my eyes adjusted to the light, it was the Studs is an old 1940s theater that has been repurposed into a porn theater. And the current owner has chopped it up into a bit of a multiplex. There's three smaller rooms that show three different types of porn, depending on what your taste is. And then the main room shows gay porn. And it's kind of this, you know, it's like you can still see these vestiges of what this building was. It has these beautiful red chandeliers. You know, it's this old movie house, but it, you know, it's a little run down. And, yeah. And we were there in the middle of the afternoon, and we were kind of getting cruised by a bunch of older men that hang out there.
You were there with another guy.
I was there with an artist named Zach Smith. He is a painter, an L.A. painter who has been in porn and actually did a graphic written memoir called We Did Porn that talks about that whole experience. And so I thought it would be interesting to go with somebody who's been in porn to sort of describe and talk to me about what the purpose of the porn theater served and serves.
What is the purpose? Why would anyone go to a porn theater now?
Well, I think what we're looking at now is the vestigial sort of remnants of the porn theater. Back in the day, you know, in the 70s, it was the only, unless you were getting 8 millimeter stag films that you were buying under the counter somewhere, it was pretty much the only place to see porn.
Yeah.
Like, they were films. They were actually shot on film, celluloid film. And so if you were going to see porn, it was going to be in a theater. That changed starting in the early to mid 1980s when VHS became a phenomenon. And that's when the porn theater really began to enter its decline. So I think what we're looking at now are kind of these relics of another era that remain.
But I guess this is an activity that one normally does in private.
Yeah, but you know, there's always the exhibitionist types who are, you know, into kind of sharing the experience. I think also, you know, a point that one of the sources I spoke to for the story made is that porn theaters also became this a very important space for LGBTQ people starting in the 1970s, mm-hmm. when hardcore mm-hmm. porn was legalized and these theaters became a more sort of accepted part of the urban landscape. And so it was this place where you could be yourself, where you wouldn't necessarily be seen.
Mm-hmm. You could meet other people, maybe.
You could meet other people, and sometimes that was the purpose in both anonymous and non-anonymous ways. And so they were this kind of safe space. And so they did serve that purpose as well.
Okay, down the road a bit. Mm-hmm. Going east, you have Tiki, the Tiki Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that.
The Tiki was once a storefront. It's not a theater. A lot of porn theaters were once old theaters that were repurposed. This is an old storefront. It was once a liquor store and an electronics shop. And it is now a theater, and it's essentially just a few rows of conference room chairs of the kind you might see at KCRW and a very large screen. And you go through this door with all of these advisories about keeping your zipper up. And
in Spanish.
In very badly written Spanish. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Spanish through Google through something else. Like, I don't know where they got that Spanish. And it's probably a couple dozen seats at most. It's small. It's uh-huh. the size of a small convenience store. And it's in a little bit more
rundown. This is a straight
rundown.
Porn theater.
This is a straight porn theater. Mm-hmm. There was no one there when we went there in the early
evening. What were they showing?
Late afternoon. It was something about big butts. If I remember correctly. it had a plot, believe it or not, and it was like a Jerry Springer type show where this very, you know, this host has his guests and they're kind of fighting and then they all end up doing it as one does on
Right. Doesn't seem too far-fetched.
No, not at all.
From reality.
Exactly.
Okay, so what's your takeaway visiting these two theaters when it comes to porn and porn in public?
I think they tell, for me, I was really interested in this story because they do represent this really interesting urbanistic story about Los Angeles, and I'm very interested in urbanism and architecture. A lot of those theaters were 1930s and 40s theaters that by the 70s were in decline for a couple of reasons. One, there was the flight to the suburbs, mm-hmm. and two, there was the rise of the multiplex. The multiplex came around in the late 1960s, so why would you go see a movie at some rundown 1930s theater when you could go to the multiplex? So all of a sudden you had this movie theater stock that was sitting around unused, and that's why it became they became popular as porn houses. And it's also the story of technology, of these places that had their moment in American society at this moment of sexual liberation, the sexual revolution, at a time when women did things like go to a porn movie because it was kind of the cool thing to do. It at one point in the late 60s, Jackie Kennedy was photographed coming out of a Swedish softcore flick in Manhattan. So it was this very accepted thing that in
that
the
is amazing to think. The yes. first lady going to a
yeah. I mean, can you imagine film? Laura Bush being photographed coming out of a softcore movie? Like, it just wouldn't happen today. And so it's this intersection of urbanism and technology. And technology, the VHS and later the internet just doing away with these spaces because now you could see it in private. You know, there's yeah. really not the need for it. And cheaper, you know, that you know, you can download a movie for $10 and
right.
Not
but
have
it
to
also
pay to
says something
theater.
About how conservative, as you say, we've gotten in
yes.
terms of our sexual mores and
exactly.
All that.
I mean, some of it has to do a part of the decline of those theaters are, you know, local communities started to pass ordinances against them. So, for example, in 1981, Santa Monica passed an ordinance that allowed the construction of or development of no new adult theaters. So they kind of kept the adult, they didn't outlaw them because that would have been too tricky, but they didn't allow for the development or construction of new ones. So it meant that as the old ones closed, new ones could not rise to fill it. And so, you know, in a community like Santa Monica, you don't have porn theaters anymore. I mean, you don't have them in a lot of places.
Well,
they
yeah,
just
or
don't
anywhere,
exist.
I would say.
Exactly.
Except for Santa Monica Boulevard, there are two.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was really interesting.
Thank you for having me.
Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she's a regular contributor here at Press Play, and that'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.